This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio with a question. What is life? No, I'm not going on with the show until you answer that. Actually, this question has occupied philosophers and theologians for centuries, and it has spawned sprawling cosmologies and convoluted theologies, but a clear answer has proved elusive. Well, my next guest says there is a simpler answer, and it can be found in physics. 20 years ago, Adrian Bejan gave us what he called the constructal law. It showed an evolutionary pattern in all matter, organic and inorganic. In his new book, he expands the theory to show the way physical forces govern the direction of evolution. The physics of life goes beyond biology to understand the driving forces that support life on Earth. Adrian Bejan is a professor of mechanical engineering at Duke University and joins us now on The State of Things. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So tell us about this idea of physics over and against, say, biology, a physical way of looking at life. Versus biology. What's the distinction?
Well, okay, before I answer, let me point out that biology is, nothing more than a chapter in physics. Everything in the biology obeys the laws of physics. Everything else, meaning every other domain, say sociology and hydrology and everything, obeys the laws of physics. This is why they are the laws, to be obeyed. Now, the physics of life is the following. Life is a movement. If the movement stops, that is death. When nothing moves, in physics, by the way, we call it the dead state. This idea of death in physics has been with us since the mid-1800s. And it occurred to me that the opposite of that deserves a name and a place in physics, and I called it a live state. Live state is the being of an entity that is populated by flows and has the freedom to morph its configuration in order to facilitate those flows. This is the live state. Now, to answer your question, the meaning of life as physics is the following. Nothing moves. Absolutely nothing moves unless it is pushed, unless it is driven. The pushing comes from power which is spent, so that the mover gets its environment out of the way. To move from A to B, the body has to be pushed by a force to a particular distance with a particular speed. So force times speed is power. That is the power that is actually destroyed through effects such as friction. During movement, the power, and this is now my domain of specialty, comes from engines or power plants, natural or human-made. And the power plants produce the power by consuming fuel or, in the case of animal power plants, food. Mm-hmm. So to summarize, there is the consumption of fuel or food. The production of power, the power is destroyed for the purpose of moving absolutely everything, including from animal migration to river water to our stuff on the highways. And that movement, as I said, destroys the power. And at the end of the day, fuel is consumed, and on the surface of the earth, stuff was moved from one place to another, and that means the earth's crust was mixed and remixed. By these engines.
But let me ask you, it doesn't really destroy the power, right? It just reconfigures it, right? I mean, it's been employed in a new way, and it's found a new form, but it's power in a different form. Now it's
No. Power is destroyed. Everything that concerns movement is a mechanism or an opportunity for power to be destroyed. Without power in the first place, there is no movement.
You wouldn't say it's transformed. The idea that I've lifted something has transformed whatever energy and calories that I use to make the object that I lifted.
Oh, I see. Okay. I'm referring to power the way you began, the power spent on lifting something. Mm-hmm. It is, of course, first law of thermodynamics proclaims the conservation of energy. That power that you spent eventually is dumped as heat, rejected as heat to the ambient. That kind of power, meaning heat flowing to the ambient, is useless. So,
To me, once I picked up my apple. Well, let me ask you this question. You, in the preface, you say life is a universal tendency in nature. Now, from our, you know, vantage point, there's a lot less life than that. There's a lot more inorganic stuff than organic stuff. There's, right? I mean, there's more dead stuff than live stuff. There are more rocks than people. So my question is, what do you mean if life is a universal tendency? Are you saying that all things, that all inorganic stuff is tending to want to be alive?
I define life as the being of an entity to flow and to morph freely so it flows more easily. This tendency or this urge is widely visible in anything that moves, including the things you mentioned, the inanimate things, the water, the falling rocks, the rolling stones. Animate, inanimate, this is a division of science or academia that comes from the church. In physics, as I said much earlier, there is no distinction between these things because they all obey the laws. So the urge to have movement with freer and freer improvement in configuration is non-denominational. It doesn't care about inanimate or versus animate. This is a phenomenon of physics because it is the broadest imaginable.
Why is there so little? I would be curious about this. Why is there, relatively speaking, so little of what we would call animate versus the stone that just sits there, that wasn't pushed by some force down the hill? It is inert, and there is no force that acted on it. Now, we know it's moving. There's still, you know, little atoms in there spinning away, so it's not totally inanimate, right? I mean, there's something going on with that rock.
You said several things, and let me try to take them one by one. First of all, the inanimate world is older than the animate world. That begins to answer your question as to which is bigger. Second is the reality that, yes, the winds and the oceanic currents and the tectonic plate movement are actually mixing the Earth's crust big time. But the newcomer called the biosphere is doing a big, big job on adding its geological ages one at a time in that mixing performance. So I don't see a difference between them where I wouldn't rank them as champion versus runner-up. Going back to your bouncing atoms, in a construct law, the construct law begins with drawing attention to a finite size system. That means a thing that's much, much bigger than the atoms that you imagine and you have not seen. It is drawing attention to flow with configuration, meaning a channel surrounded by a background, a black one, a white. These tiny things are not an issue. There are immense numbers of these things that are responsible for the pixels in your photograph. It is macroscopic flow configuration that morphs freely and in fact illustrates what should be recognized as live flow system in physics. And that thing that flows has the urge, and it manifests that urge every time and everywhere, the urge to morph, not only to flow more easily, but to become more free to morph more, to flow more easily.
What would you say, or have you speculated on the adaptive advantage to this? In other words, you know, again, looking retrospectively, we think the animal that became the giraffe, there was some advantage to getting a long neck because now I can eat the taller leaves. And so we look retrospectively and say, oh, that's the, and in quote, reason that that this would evolve a structure like a longer neck. So why do things tend to flow? Why do things want to be in this condition or urge toward this condition of wanting to flow and wanting to morph?
I like your example. The answer is that the giraffe, in order to live better, longer, more easily on the land, must have easier access to food. The food that was available to it, but not to other competitors, was high on top of the tree canopy, and that explains the giraffe configuration. I have my own wonderful stories about the giraffe. But okay, the point is, you name the example from biology, which is descriptive, which ends with, well, the reason is so that the giraffe could reach the top of the tree, or the aardvark could dig faster under the anthill. But the physics question, which I'm answering, is why each of these highly dissimilar animals has the urge to do this versus that. And the urge is one. The urge is to move on the landscape with greater ease, with farther reach, and with greater longevity. All of these things mean life.
So, in other words, you preserve. I mean, I guess I've heard an answer to this that's similar in the sense that what you have in inanimate objects, if I can go back to that distinction again, is a higher degree of entropy. Things just fall apart, and they continue on that track of falling apart with nothing to check the entropy, the disintegration, and reproduction and biology. This biological life structure tends to preserve better. And you would say that nature really would love to preserve itself if it could, and life was really one very good answer in flow and preservation.
I agree with what you just said, except to caution the audience with regard to accepting the word entropy that you pronounced. In thermodynamics, entropy, very unfortunately, has been given as a name to many, many different concepts. Entropy, original thermodynamics, means essentially entropy generation, means the generation of heat through mechanical friction. That is the entropy that could be spoken here. The one that you brought up refers once again to the imaginary world of the infinitesimal atoms and particles bouncing in arguably a disordered manner. There's another entropy there which is known and taught in the statistical thermodynamics. That is not the physics of finite size systems. That is the physics of imaginary infinitesimal systems. And I'm actually presenting the physics of life to an audience as modest as I am, with the physics learned in middle school, or for that matter, physics developed in the mid-1700s. If we don't get it with a physics as elementary and as simple as that, we will never get it.
But you're saying essentially the same thing, though, even if I misused the term entropy or used it maybe in the wrong context, that disintegration happens faster in organic life than for organic life. Life itself is the thing that preserves and tends to act as a check against falling apart.
No, I don't know, again, how to rank these things. What has happened in science, because of the many, many kinds of entropies in the circulation, is that the disorganization, which is actually taught correctly at the infinitesimal level, has been imported as true when one looks at the complexity of a flow configuration, say in a vascularized tissue or in the brain, or migratory paths in southern Africa for animals. The drawing looks complicated and confusing. Well, disorganization. Description of complexity has nothing to do with the birth of the connection between disorganization and entropy in statistical mechanics.
So why is it, do you think, that there is this urge? What's in it for nature to want to move, to flow, and to be alive?
Well, nobody knows. This is why each of these urges is a law, a self-standing tendency, or in fact, the name for it is a distinct phenomenon. The law of physics is not an explanation. The law of physics is a very brief summary of a particular phenomenon that manifests itself billions and billions of times the same way. So I don't know why this where this tendency comes from, because I cannot deduce it from the other laws that I know and teach very well.
But you see it in a lot of different things. I mean, you talked about flight patterns, for instance, showing us how these patterns tend to emerge even in something as, you know, sort of humanly configured as flight.
Sure, yeah, and also in the city traffic and in the movement of pedestrians on the Duke campus, or for that matter, the movement of people like me in my own building from many offices to very few toilets. On the airplane, the same way. Emergency evacuation is if you have a movie of these bodies flowing, you'll see basically the flow of water in the river basin.
And flight patterns, where
and
we
the
see
flight
airplanes.
Patterns, the flight patterns, we saw this, by the way, our generation, almost overnight when during the deregulation of the air traffic system in the U.S. and then later in Europe. The river-like flow of flyers all over the globe happened in the same way that river basins happen, because of the human urge to get from here to everywhere else with greater ease, which means more cheaply, ultimately with less fuel.
Talking today to Adrian Bajan. He's a professor of mechanical engineering at Duke University, and he has a new book called The Physics of Life. You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Adrian, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things, a program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton Ormond, and Katie Barron. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.